Let's Take This Outside with Marianne Iveson, the podcast where she speaks to athletes, outdoor professionals, and scientists about why they connect with nature.
Dr. Daniel Scott is a professor and research chair in the Department of Geography and Environmental Management at the University of Waterloo. He has worked extensively on sustainable tourism for 25 years, with a focus on the transition to a low-carbon tourism economy and adaptation to the complex impacts of a changing climate. In 2021, he ranked in the world top 300 climate change scientists by Reuters. In 2023, he was recognized as one of Canada's top scholars when he was inducted as a fellow to the Royal Society of Canada. I cannot wait to share what we've learned today. Please welcome Dr. Daniel Scott. Dr. Daniel Scott, welcome to Let's Take This Outside. I really appreciate you taking time in the middle of your, I'm assuming, schedule of your day classes.
Not today. I don't have to teach today, but it's awesome to be with you today.
Take me back to when the interest started for you to study the link between climate change and the travel industry and kind of your background and what led to me wanting to talk to you today.
Yeah, so that goes back about 25 years ago. I first started to do some work with Parks Canada, both as it relates to their protection mandate and as well as their tourism mandate, and then kept getting asked by agencies like the UN World Tourism Organization and others at an international scale, really interested in looking at, well, what does it mean for tourism globally, not just in Canada? What does it mean for small island developing states that rely on tourism for their GDP and a lot of employment? And then we got into certain specific areas like, well, what does it mean for the ski industry? One of the ones that some would call a canary in the coal mine, where you'd expect to see some of the impacts first and foremost, coastal areas, things like that. So that's what our focus over the last 20 years has been.
Was there a light bulb moment for you where you're like, oh, yes, this is something that I definitely want to dive into, or there's something that you uncovered that you're like, oh, this is worth my time, my effort?
Yeah, I think most people don't realize how much tourism represents in terms of the global economy. Like, it's roughly 10% of the global economy. 10% of people have jobs related to tourism around the world. And that goes much higher, as we said, in small island developing states, you know, like Jamaica or Dominican Republic, or even Mexico. You know, that can be 25, 50% of employment for a lot of people. So, and we saw that under the pandemic when that hit that industry hard. You know, credit ratings, borrowing costs, unemployment, and some of those nations don't have unemployment insurance the way we understand it. And so then their kids don't go to school with the right clothes. They can't get in their tuition paid, the healthcare, everything else suffers. So climate change is going to hit the tourism industry in two ways. One, through climate risks, the sort of things that we see this winter with the warmth that we've had. But also, you know, you have to get people to these places. And so as we decarbonize the economy, that has repercussions for tourism as well. So there's two big challenges for tourism to overcome to be able to still be that development mechanism for many parts of the world.
When you say decarbonize the economy, what does that mean?
Yeah, so to achieve our, not just our country, but the globe's Paris Climate Agreement goals, we have to reduce emissions by 45 to 50% by 2030. That's a big ask. So that's probably not going to happen. But by mid-century, we have to achieve what's called net zero. So the amount of carbon and other greenhouse gases that we're putting into the atmosphere has to be the equivalent to what natural systems can take back out of the atmosphere, so that essentially it's sort of leveled off, it's stabilized. That requires emission reductions, you know, closer to the 90% range from sort of 2000 or so. So those are both heavy lifts. The world's making progress, not as fast as many people would want it to be. But we're headed in the right direction, but still it's going to be a monumental task. That's the kind of energy transition that's never happened that quickly in all of history. So even with the technologies and then the brain power we have around the world, it's still going to be a challenge.
Clearly you care about the environment and you know, you don't want the world to end in the next 100 years or so. But personally, do you have a stake in this game when it comes to, specifically, let's talk about snow and climate change? Like, have you seen it personally? Are you an athlete? Like, I think I heard another podcast that your wife is Swedish. Was it Swedish?
Austrian. So yeah.
Austrian,
she's skiing in Whistler today with my younger daughter.
Oh, okay, wonderful.
While I'm at home. Yeah, yeah. So they've got it. They've got the good part of it. For me, I don't have, you know, a financial or as an athlete. I work with Protect Our Winters, which is an athletes-based organization. So I know many people who are in the outdoor industry who are elite athletes, including some of my former students. So engage with them all the time, as well as investors, you know, putting money into ski resorts, the real estate at ski resorts. I don't have a personal stake in those in that regard. But, you know, I think I've seen certainly in the last 20 years, changes that have come in a Canadian context, US context, Europe. We have family in Austria. So again, where some of the elite athletes from Austria and others places would have trained in the summer, some of those have closed. So those observations have come. And I think this winter in particular was really visible to most Canadians and most Americans east of the Rocky Mountains. So if you were in the Midwest, if you were in the Great Lakes region, if you were in the Northeast US, this isn't a winter like you remembered 10 years ago, or certainly not when I was a kid 30, 40 years ago. This one really sort of, I think, grabbed people's attention. The same way some of the fire seasons, the heat dome that we had in Seattle and southern BC, you know, 40 degrees in Victoria and interior BC, even meteorologists didn't think that was coming, you know, that quickly. So every once in a while we get these climate anomalies that we would have expected in mid-century coming seemingly 30, 40 years too early.
And, you know, personally here in Ottawa, I don't know if you spend much time up here, but of course there's a lot of ski hills around here, but I cross country ski. And in this area, like we were skiing, I think until April last year, because you can cross country ski for a while. It depends how much base you have. But a lot of us have already moved over to cycling and getting our bikes out because Gatineau Park is almost abysmal for snow now. So
yeah, and one of the showcases, and I did a number of interviews last year, we had done a study on the canal and the ability to have the skateway open, I think in 2005, and we predicted the shortening season, etc. We didn't think you wouldn't be able to get it open last year or this year for like a handful of days. So again, that came earlier than we thought, but it was consistent with what we thought would have been coming. And so that's some of the unfortunate things that some of the early work we did 20 years ago are, we're now starting to see those things play out, maybe not as often as, you know, we would expect it to be in two decades from now, but they're already starting to hit, you know, businesses and public in terms of their winter recreation, their winter tourism in ways that we thought it would.
I was going to actually ask you about the Rideau Canal not even opening last year, which is a huge deal for not only Ottawa tourism, but people and families who plan their entire vacation around skating on the Rideau Canal. I've been lucky enough to do it many times, but even this year was very short. Last year, like you said, it didn't open. As we talk about the snow, and as we're going to talk about specifically ski hills during our conversation, but of course, this also affects snow, cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, fat biking, outdoor skating, the Rideau Canal, snowmobiling. There's just so many other sports. So I want people to know that when we talk about this, it's not just downhill skiing that we're talking about, although which is a huge sport in Canada.
And I would just add to that, when we talk about, you know, the ski industry, and all the studies we've done, we include snowmaking, you know, advanced snowmaking as part of our analysis. And that's something most ski areas in Ontario, Quebec, New England, Midwest have had that for 20 years. It's getting more efficient. But those other sectors that you talk, you can't make snow over hundreds of kilometers of trail for cross-country skiing. Little bits you can. Snowmobiling, you can't do it over thousands of kilometers of trail. And then they need safe ice crossings to connect their trails. And you know, so all the other winter recreational activities, tourism activities, typically are actually more vulnerable to climate change than the ski industry, downhill ski industry, because they don't have the adaptive capacity of making their own snow. You can't freeze up the canal. You can't make those river crossings safe for snowmobiling. You get what Mother Nature gives you.
I will ask you about snowmaking later too. This is kind of a basic question, but what is sustainable tourism? Because it comes up a lot in your studies.
Yeah, so that probably depends on who you ask. Both in industry and government and academics, you could probably ask 20 people and you might get 20 slightly different answers. There are sort of standard definitions that the UN World Tourism Organization, even Destination Canada, probably has one. But it's trying to make tourism more sustainable, not just in the environment, but in terms of social impact. So you may have heard a term like over-tourism, too many people impacting Barcelona, Venice, you know, nature areas. So it includes both the social and the environmental, and but also the economic. How do you ensure tourism actually contributes back to the local economy, sustains small businesses, doesn't just take money back out? And so it's all three pillars of sustainable development, but specific to tourism. So how can tourism, you know, support sustainable development at a destination scale, whether that's a community, whether that's a country, or even around the world?
And at an individual level, you know, you kind of glazed over a few of those. Is there something we can do individually as we're planning our next trip?
Yeah. So everything from, you know, where you go, your destination choice, your mode of transport can have a big difference. Also what you do when you get there. But for example, and this is where a part of a discussion on snowmaking comes in. You know, if you're in Montreal or Toronto and you go on a ski holiday to Tremblant or Blue Mountain, and maybe you've already got an electric car that's charged with a pretty green grid already, decarbonized grid, you're essentially having a net zero holiday now. If somebody took away that snowmaking and said, well, you know, you couldn't ski locally, well, you'd have two choices. If you really want to ski, you might have to fly out to Whistler or Colorado or where have you. Your emission footprint's going to go way up. Or you could say, well, we can't ski. We're going to go on a cruise. Your emissions are going to go even further up. So a lot of those choices that we would make different than staying regionally for a ski holiday come with a much bigger carbon footprint. So that's part of the choices that people make every year. Where do I go? When I go, how long do I stay there? So instead of going to Vegas every weekend for three times in a year, if you go to Vegas once, you get rid of the other two flights. Same with if you go to Australia. Okay, go there once, but make it a month-long, you know, bucket list trip. See everything you wanted to see. Don't have to fly back five more times in your lifetime, and the missions of seeing all of that will come once.
Hi, I'm Steve Yerko.
And I'm Tara Sands. Now available from Maji Media is our new podcast, 4Kids Flashback. 4Kids is the company who brought you the English dub of Pokemon in the late 90s and so many other shows like Yu-Gi-Oh!, Shaman King, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Kirby, the infamous One Piece dub, and so many more.
We'll be talking to the people who worked at 4Kids. Actors, directors, writers, editors, producers, engineers, you get the point. And hopefully get the answers to questions both you and I have about the company.
I actually worked there as a voice actor on some of the shows.
And I was a kid watching the shows and remember way more than Tara does.
And thank God for that. Steve is actually a professional storyboard artist, which gives some really unique insights into anime and animation. Subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts. That's the number 4Kids Flashback.
Let's Take This Outside now has a newsletter. Keep up to date with outdoor news, events, and great discount codes and deals from our partners. Sign up today at letstakethisoutside.ca.
A friend of mine sent me the article that kind of spurred me emailing you in the first place. It was in The Guardian. It was called "Ski Resorts Era of Plentiful Snow May Be Over Due to Climate Crisis," study finds. So a fear of mine, and you can confirm this or not, is that I will not be able to cross-country ski. This is very selfish, but I feel like I speak for a lot of people, is I won't be able to cross-country ski in like 20 years. That's my thought, and that's why I try to ski as much as possible now.
That could be fair. What'll happen is it'll become much more variable, and you've probably already seen that if you've been a cross-country skier in your whole lifetime. Over the last decade in particular, things like one winter, you'll have a good dump of snow and you'll be able to ski for 3 or 4 weeks. And then you might get a rain or a melt. But that you know, good amount of snow may come later. It doesn't stay nearly as long. You get these midwinter breaks. we had here in Waterloo, we had a green Christmas. Like I golfed with my wife on December 5th and we golfed again March 2nd. That is not winter in a Southern Ontario context. Like there was maybe when the polar vortex paid us a visit for about 10 days and I think you got the same, you know, there was about a 10-day period where we could cross country ski locally. But after that, that was it. And so here, our sort of February is our coldest month. It's the daytime average is supposed to be or has been historically, you know, about -4. So conducive to keeping that snowpack. This year, it's not even close. And most scenarios, even low emission scenarios we have around here, that goes well, you know, above zero. So we wouldn't have that kind of continuous snowpack here. So yeah, that would be the end of cross-country skiing here. I think you guys are a bit colder, bit more hopeful, but still it'll become more variable in the, you know, in the decades ahead for sure. Hopefully not completely gone for you in 20 years, but it'll be on its way, unfortunately.
Is there something also about this year? Now I keep reading like headlines about like, oh, it just happens to be a warmer year. Like, can you kind of crush any of that for me? Or like, is it just a warmer year? Like, is it specifically, or is this part of the trend?
A bit of both. It's part of the trend. We, you know, we saw that last year. What is different this year? It's an El Nino and a strong El Nino year. And that is a year when the Pacific just in that cycle releases a lot of heat that it has accumulated over the last while it wasn't in an El Nino cycle. So, and that's often what moderates winters across North America, but other parts of the world, it changes rain patterns and things like that too. But here, because it was a strong one, again, on our side of the Rockies, you know, some people in the States, you know, said it was the winter that was lost. Like they really did not, you know, through Minnesota, the ice fishing, the snowmobiling, all those things that are pretty, you know, common in the center of the continent just didn't happen. And so this year was, it didn't just sort of slightly break records. It crushed records in much of the U.S., in Midwest, the Great Lakes region. The Great Lakes really had almost no ice coverage to speak of, and that too is not nearly normal. And then, yeah, having, you know, 15-degree day, like tomorrow is supposed to be 15 here, 16 the day after. And we've had those, you know, a week or two ago. Like, we just don't usually have that kind of prolonged heat through winter. And what was a bit different this one, it was, you know, almost continent wide. Sometimes, you know, New England or, you know, British Columbia might have a really warm season and poor snow conditions. Rarely do we get it when it's continent wise like this. So this one is, yeah, both an anomaly, but also, you know, a learning opportunity for the businesses and others that really rely on winter snow-based tourism. They're going to have to look at, well, how are we going to do things differently?
You said in the article, we are probably past the era of peak ski seasons. And we just kind of talked about that. But how is climate change directly affecting the downhill ski industry?
Two ways. Up until about 7 years ago, ski seasons on average were actually getting slightly longer. And what I mean by that is from the average ski seasons across the US and Canada from the 1980s to the 90s got longer. 90s to the 2000s, they got longer again, because we were investing hundreds of millions of dollars in snowmaking. So that was extending the season so we could begin a little bit earlier, we could end a little bit late, smoothing out the bumps, those mid-season melts. And so that was helping to extend the season. Even with that advanced snowmaking, that's now changed. So in the last sort of decade, 7 years in particular, we haven't had this year to include in the data set yet. Average seasons have stabilized in the Rocky Mountain zone, but are shorter in the Pacific West, shorter in the Midwest, shorter in the Great Lakes region, the Northeast, Ontario, Quebec. So snowmaking is not able to keep up with the warming anymore. If it was, we wouldn't see that pattern. So that's why I said we're probably past that point of peak length of ski seasons, because the snowmaking just won't be able to keep up with it anymore.
U.S. and Canadian ski hills seem to have different data and trends, but I was looking over some of your papers. Can you explain the differences? Because obviously, I'm just assuming, and from a very basic understanding, you know, Canada's farther north, right? But I feel like there are some differences between U.S. and Canada when it comes to those trends.
certainly in terms of data and understanding the trends, not just in season length, but all kinds of operational key performance indicators from snowmaking to profitability. It's the U.S. has amazing data and we have nothing like it, unfortunately.
Right, okay.
So
okay.
That's why we do studies like the one we just published in the U.S. and we can't do it in Canada. I do a lot of the work I do with an Austrian colleague. We can't do the same studies there either. They too just don't have the kind of data that the U.S. has. So, and they have it over a long time series, which is really important to understand trends. Like the ones we just talked about, from season lengths actually getting longer in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. We can't document that in Canada, but we can document it extremely well in all parts of the U.S. regional markets. So that is one of the big differences. But you're right. I mean, when we compare, you know, Quebec and Ontario with the New England or the Northeast markets, Quebec does much better. High elevation Vermont and New Hampshire have that elevation advantage. When we go into the Midwest, again, if there were for snowmobiling and things like that, they are typically longer seasons in Northern Ontario, Manitoba, etc. And then, you know, West Whistler has an advantage over California. Central BC has an climate advantage over Colorado and Utah. They're high, but BC is just typically that much colder, more reliable cold and snow. So typically we do have that bit of a competitive advantage compared to our neighbors to the south, particularly the more southern ones like, you know, Southern California or, you know, even southern or low-lying Colorado. We do have advantages over them.
That makes a lot more sense now looking at what you put out. I'm like, oh, it's just because he has more data on the U.S. because they have more information. That makes way more sense to me. Okay.
Yeah, we just can't do these kind of economic studies in Canada. We just don't have the economic data to allow it to happen.
So I was out west last week. I was in Calgary. I was in Banff. I was out there and I heard Sunshine had used their max availability for snowmaking and that it was a rough year everywhere, right? And it takes water and electricity for snowmaking, which also impacts the environment. So what role does snowmaking make now? And it looks like it will just keep growing over the next decade.
Yeah. So in all the analysis we've done in any country, any regional market in North America, to sort of offset as much of that loss of season length, we're going to rely on more snowmaking. So that's a given in any market. So you do want to make that as sustainable as possible. I think snowmaking has been unfairly criticized at times as all snowmaking is unsustainable, and that's not the case. It's really a spectrum from some stuff that is really unsustainable to stuff that is really quite sustainable. And on the positive side, if we take a province like Quebec, the electricity grid is entire hydro. So your snowmaking has no carbon footprint. You could double the amount of snowmaking. You could triple it. Wouldn't matter. There's no carbon footprint. So yes, you're using energy, but the emissions that would feed back into climate change don't happen because it's a clean grid. And Ontario is largely the same, not quite as good, but we're mostly nuclear and hydro. That is very different in Alberta. When they make snow, there's still coal in their electricity grid. Colorado is the same. So making snow in another part of North America comes with a much bigger carbon footprint, and same with your lifts and all the stuff that comes with it. So that's where the differences really, really happen. That being said, most state and provincial jurisdictions are looking to completely clean their grid sometime in the 2030s, hopefully sooner rather than later. But the same way Ontario got rid of its coal fire plants, the hope is, you know, the Albertas, Colorados of the world will do the same in the not too distant future. So that will get better and better. On the water side, about close to 90% of the water that's used in snowmaking melts back down into the same watershed the next spring. So you're kind of borrowing it over a period of 4 or 5, maybe 6 months tops. And so it really matters, where did you get that water from? So many ski areas, as you know, in Southern Ontario and Quebec have their own purpose-built reservoirs. They capture spring runoff. When there's plentiful water, they keep it. Sometimes they use it for things in the summer, golf courses, you know, other activities like Blue Mountain. And then they'll put some of that back on the hill. Others like Blue Mountain have a pipeline to Lake Huron. So an endless supply of water in that case. So that too can be, is at the very sustainable end of things. Like you're not drawing on natural systems and taking water to drain a lake or something like that. That being said, there are poor uses of water. There's been times in California when they've used groundwater. Well, that's not a sustainable use. Even though, yes, most of that comes back into the same watershed, it's not, you've pulled it out of the ground and it takes a long time to replenish that kind of water. So that's the kind of practice you want to not see in the ski industry and get closer to those sort of purpose-built reservoirs, which can actually help if they're done well. They can be help with spring flood control. You can fill those things up and then make use of them the next fall. So that's, you know, and that's every region's a little bit different, every destination, how they want to distribute water, who, you know, who's the priority users. And so that's a decision made locally, but it can vary and can be quite sustainable.
Is there any good news? You're pretty hopeful in the beginning of this episode, but is there something that we can have hope in around this?
Well, in the ski industry, every regional market we've looked at in North America, there's winners and losers, so to speak. There are some places that are more climate resilient in every region. So skiing is not going to be obliterated, as some people might argue. In an Eastern North American context, Quebec is actually quite climate resilient, and will be, its competitiveness will only improve. High elevation Vermont and New Hampshire, again, at least through mid-century, even a high emission scenario, are okay. The lower lying stuff, the Massachusetts, Pennsylvania's, Southern Ontario to some extent, parts of New York State that rely on lake effect snow that will probably come more and more as lake effect rain, they will be hit. Parts of California as well, but Colorado, central BC, even Whistler, high elevation, they'll be fine as well. So what we'll see is the competitiveness of the ski industry will change. The geography of where we will ski will change. It will kind of, you know, turn into fewer and fewer places. And we've asked skiers, if you couldn't ski at your normal place, you know, where would you go? And so we have some sense in Ontario and Quebec market of where the big destinations will be. So those places that are climate resilient in that respect, they're going to have to continue to invest in ski industry, not just to get more people up on the hill, but that's important. But your parking services, your retail, your restaurants, your comb, all of those things that lead to a positive skier visitor experience, you know, it sounds wrong in some respects, but those places are going to have to continue to invest to provide that ski experience. And in other places, we know they'll probably fall out of the marketplace. It could be 5 years, it could be 15 years. We really don't know that the business case in each destination.
So what you're saying is, depending where you live, you might have to get a downhill bike is what you might have to transition to. Not that I need to make this light or anything. But.
Certainly people, but also the ski areas. Like, I mean, Blue Mountain added huge mountain biking capacity years ago, as well as other things. They've all, those bigger destinations, have all sort of diversified their seasonal offerings for 10, 15, 20 years. And a place like Whistler now gets more visitors in the green season than they do in the ski season. Even though it is known as an internationally renowned ski destination, they get more people coming in the green season now.
That's not terrible news.
Yeah, I mean, so everywhere has got to look at, you know, what does our future look like? And when I've talked to some CEOs of ski areas, that's how they look at it. You know, they look at it as business risk. Some of them will have improved competitiveness, the other end. And so both are going to have to adapt, but for slightly different reasons and with different strategies. And the sooner they kind of know which of those groups they're going to be in, the sooner they can make strategic decisions in terms of what they're going to invest in.
Dr. Daniel Scott, thank you so much for taking time to talk about the ski industry, the travel industry. I really appreciate you taking time today. And hopefully I might pick your brain again soon on other things and the climate change. So.
For sure. It's not going away. So it was great to be with you today.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. For more Let's Take This Outside, go to letstakethisoutside.ca.
Hey, listeners, I'm Christy.
And I'm Melissa. And this is Buried Motives, where we dig deep into the details of some of the most gruesome
dirtbag murderers.
She said she enjoyed hurting things that can't fight back.
And that is a disturbing view into the mind of a murderer. And such a dirtbag.
Yeah, that's not even strong enough words. This is totally a recipe for disaster. And not to justify whatever is going to happen, but you can totally understand and see how this would be in the works.
If you were only to look at what she did later on and not know any of that history, she would appear like off the wall crazy.
Oh, 100%. Because we're not even close to getting to the end yet. But you can just see this pattern and all this kind of stuff developing in her, which is what we're here for. We're digging deep.
Join us each Thursday as we unearth the dirtbags that live among us.
And the motives buried there. Hope you join us as we exhume the truth.
Produced and distributed by the Sound Off Media Company.